Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order February 7th, 2024. Time's 9:07. We're a little bit late this morning, but we'll try to keep it on time. With me today is Chairman Hoffman, Chairman Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Wilson, myself, Stedman. We got the full contingent here. We have four items on the agenda. We have Office of Management and Budget response to previous committee questions, and then Ledge Finance response to previous committee questions, and then we'll turn the committee, we'll take a brief at ease, we'll turn the committee over to Senator Olson, and he'll bring up two bills, Senate Bill 141 and Senate Bill 24. But before we get rolling on today's agenda, Senator Wilson, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to give an apology to Director Sanders. I told her that I made a mistake on the record, and it was about Edgecombe school funding. It wasn't not in the maintenance list of the REA, but it was just under a different funding. Why it was vetoed was correct in that explanation. So just wanted to say that on the record.
Okay. With that, we'd go ahead and have Ms. Sanders come forward, I guess. She's first up. Office of Management and Budget from the administration.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders, Office of Management and Budget Director for the Governor's Office, Office of the Governor. I'm going to if it's the will of the committee, I'll continue through the responses that were provided in the prior letter to the committee dated February 1st, 2024.
We'll have a brief at ease. Back on the record, Ms. Sanders, I guess you could pick up where you left off the other day, and we'll just go through the questions.
Thank you. At the end of our discussion earlier, we ended on page 5 under item number 14. Senator Olson had a question about the proceeds from the sale of state-owned vessels. I'm just following up to your answer, Senator Olson, through the chair. There was an appropriation made in last year's appropriation bill, HB 39, which was Chapter 1, FSSLA 2023, and it provided an amount estimated to be $150,000.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. I also had a question about the KIC and asking why is there a reason why we are operating or keeping maintaining and operating a vessel by the Kodiak School District?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I do not have an answer to that. I can follow up with the Department of Fish and Game. I don't believe they're online today to address questions.
You can get back to the committee.
Absolutely. Okay, moving on to item number 15 on page 6, the committee requested additional information on the PFAS-related truck replacement capital request that is in the budget. The Department of Transportation is seeking $2.5 million this year. This is a three-year capital project that will be phased. And essentially, the short description is that we are cleaning the vehicles that previously distributed PFAS and replacing it with a new foam that will be able to address fires at airports. Again, this is a three-year project. It's estimated to be a total of $7.6 million to address all of the equipment that the airports have.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Sanders, just to clarify, at one point I think last year in the Transportation Committee, we'd heard that the FAA would be participating in early replacement of these trucks with airport improvement project funds. I understand that is not the case and that instead this cleaning is necessary. So the question to the executive branch is, we're confident that we know how clean is clean and we won't have groundwater cleanups to do after a fire once we've executed this project.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities confirmed there have been other entities that have replaced the foam in their vehicles, and they have a certain threshold that is required for it to be considered clean, and that is being met.
Thank you.
Okay. Next question, then.
Item number 16 was to provide an update on the Alaska Marine Highway System funding and 2024 cash flows, including receipt and non-receipt of federal funds. As the committee is aware, there was an award made on November 29th for a grant to the state of Alaska. That amount was reduced by the federal government. They allocated a certain portion that was expected to come to the state of Alaska for the Rural Ferry Program to the American Samoa government. That reduction amount was $21.3 million. I have Dom Panone on the line. He's the Admin Services Director for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and can provide any additional information or answer questions related to this.
I don't see him online.
I also have Deputy Commissioner in the room that can address questions as well.
Okay, if she can come forward. You can introduce yourself for the record and help the committee with the haircut we got from America Samoa.
For the record, Catherine Keith, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Good morning.
Be accurate in your answers. That's all I can say.
Do you want to provide an update on why that happened or what the administration is doing to address it?
Yeah, thank you. The Department of Transportation did receive a reduced award in comparison to our original request for operating funds. When we analyzed the funding from that award and the remaining funds available from last year's operating budget, we were able to determine that that funding was adequate for to meet our operating budget for this year. We had communicated with Federal Transit Administration about that award, and at this point we're accepting the award and are happy for that opportunity for that grant as well as the capital grants. And happy to answer other specific questions about this and the matching fund requirement.
So are we, I guess the question refers to FY24. We're concerned that we're going to be short of cash flow and then any impacts, obviously, that then trickle on into FY25. Can you help the committee with that?
Mr. Chair, we are confident that our budget request is adequate to meet our operating needs for fiscal year 24 and into fiscal year 25.
So you don't need any money, additional money in the FY25 budget?
Our request for fiscal year 25 does meet our needs and projections into 2025, as we don't need additional beyond the request that we have made.
We'll have a brief address. We'll come back on the table. I think the concern is when we budget, go through our budget process, we budget for a schedule. And then if the schedule's not met because of mechanicals or lack of crewing, then the system obviously will cash flow. So I guess the question that we're going to be interested in knowing is if you run that full schedule that's published, are you going to have the funds available to maintain and operate the Marine Highway to the schedule that's anticipated, both for 24 and 25, but in particular 25.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have our Program Management and Administration Director, Don Panone, on the line and able to answer questions about this. And I can just say that because of the inability to meet our scheduled service, that amount did carry over into future years, which means in this case that additional funding request, despite being shorted with our grant request, does make us able to meet our operating needs. But Mr. Panone, if you could add on to that, any details would be appreciated.
Yeah, Mr. Panone, can you help the committee with the creative financing of not running a schedule, so you don't need any appropriations to run the full schedule?
For the record, Don Panone, Director of Program Management and Administration for the Department of Transportation. So in the current calendar year 2024 budget, we had budgeted $66 million for federal funds, and we received a significantly smaller amount in the recent award from FTA. So that creates a shortfall in our 24 budget. However, I would say that the shortfall is mitigated by a couple things. In our calendar year 2023, which we just finished, we expended approximately $122 million of our $144 million budget. So that created some carry forward federal funds that from our previous FTA grant that we're going to use to mitigate the 24 shortfall. And the other part of that shortfall is there's a significant increase in our 24 budget, which the deputy commissioner indicated is it's likely more than we'll be able to spend due to crewing and available ships. So to the question of the current schedule put out, we put the schedule out based on what we could crew and what ships would be available. So at this time, that is why we were not requesting a supplemental for 2024. And for the 2025 budget, again, the budget is reflecting that we're hopeful that we can get the full federal award amount for what we've budgeted when we apply for the next round of grant funding through the FTA.
And can you just elaborate on that when you say expect the full funding? Does that include potentially America Small picking up roughly $20 million of that, or how are you dealing with that issue in your planning?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to the American Samoa receiving, it was, I think, about $20 million or $27 million of the available funds. In the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, in the new rural ferry grant program that we're leveraging, there was an exception that the Secretary of the USDOT could, at their discretion, award this money outside the parameters of the requirements that the rural ferry, serve communities 50 miles apart that we were well positioned to receive. So, of course, as a department, we are advocating and aggressive in pursuing receiving as much funding as we can. If we were to fall short, we could come for a supplemental in 25. But at this time, again, we remain hopeful that we can compete to receive all of the funding. Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll have the subcommittee work on that. I don't know how prudent that is to expect America Samoa to go quietly into the night and not grab $21 million next year. I would imagine their finance committee is going to ask for the $21 million in their budget. So, Mr. Bernome, we'll work on that issue and then the scheduling issue. We recognize that if you run no ships, we just tie them up and we have a fixed cost. We don't really want to operate our marine highway with no schedule. We're trying to get this, you know, a more reasonable schedule and pick up and hire more crew. So we'll be looking to the department to give us a full review of the hiring over the last couple of years as we go through this budget process, including the subject matter that we struggled with last year on how many people were applied, how many were interviewed, and how many were hired. And we'd like accurate, straightforward information delivered to this finance table. We don't want any curveballs. We cannot fix problems with misinformation. So, and we'll work through the issue dealing with the Marine Highway. So we'll have that conversation coming, and then we'll bring it to the full finance committee for review. But we're trying to, just as a general note, OMB, we're trying the best we can to avoid supplementals. We don't want them, but, and, you know, and every year we try, and every year we get them, and we recognize that, but let's try to work together and minimize them. And the cost of the state operations is the cost. And we'll deal with it. Okay. So any other questions on, you got a follow up on 16 before we go to 17?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
In addition to what the chairman said, a question on the coming year's budget. If memory serves, it includes also the full amount of toll credits. Do we have full approval to use those, or is that still a question mark?
So through the chair, Senator Keel, thank you for the question. So last year was our first year of requesting the toll credits in the budget for $42 million. And that was a novel financing concept, and that required us to establish policies and procedures and work with the FHWA on establishing that. So we have established the program, the policies, and the commissioner has submitted the request to FHWA to collect the first round of the $42 million of toll credits, which allows us to substitute match with federal dollars. So we anticipate being able to collect another round as soon as the first round is approved as requested in our budget. So we anticipate to be able to collect on those, but are still waiting on the first approval for the first round. Thank you.
Mr. Bernone, can you give us some rough dates on that? Because we're hopeful that this is going to work as expected. Can you give us some rough dates so we can kind of factor that in our budget process?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. We are right now, the Federal Highways is reviewing our STIP, and we are checking in with them often. We had aimed to have this in place at the beginning of the fiscal year, and the process has taken longer than we had anticipated. The moment the first round is approved, we would submit for the second round. We are working at best possible speed, but I cannot speak on behalf of the Federal Highway Administration.
Okay, maybe are we looking at just, we're not going to hold you to it, but is it like a 30-day expectation, 60-day? Can you have any idea? We recognize we can't, you don't control federal highways.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps I could commit to running down the answer and trying to get a timeline from Federal Highways Administration and follow up through OMB.
Okay, that's fine. We'll be working with you in the subcommittee on the Marine Highway anyway, and we'll be talking about that. And it'd just be nice if we knew that well before we wrapped up our budget is what I'm referencing. Any other questions? We have an added comment.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, the Federal Highways Administration and Federal Transit Administration is currently reviewing our final STIP, which was submitted approximately 3 weeks ago. And they typically have a 30-day turnaround. And then while that's not set in regulation, they have a memorandum of agreement between the two federal agencies for that turnaround. Mm-hmm. They have communicated to us that they're focusing all of their efforts right now on reviewing that. So once we have that approval back from those our federal partners, then we expect a number of those other things, such as our toll credit approvals, to be put at the front of their review pile. So I would expect, as far as approximate turnaround, that it wouldn't be within the next couple weeks, but we're can certainly provide that update right to the committee as soon as we have some details.
Yeah, Senator Hoffman is diligently waiting for that news also, because it could have significant impacts on our capital budget process.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on to 17.
You might want to stay here. Okay. Chair Stedman, the next item, number 17, was a request by the committee to clarify the Alaska Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, or STIP, concerns with the Federal Highway Administration reducing the allocation to the state of Alaska. So as was previously noted, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities did submit the STIP on January 19th, 2024. In the past, the Department of Transportation was allowed to inflate projects in the STIP by 30%, while knowing that 100% worth of funding would be provided. This year, the FHWA and others involved took a very strict interpretation, so a change in that, and required that the 30% of funding be moved out to future years and so there was no funding reduced in the STIP. And we have both Don Pannone and Deputy Commissioner here to answer additional questions if there are questions by the committee.
We will refer that to the capital budget chairman and let him deal with it. We are hoping that the Federal Highways agrees with DOT, and if they don't, then we'll work through the process, what we got to do.
Thank you.
Number 18.
The committee requested requested additional information on the statewide salary study that is being completed by the Department of Administration's Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. The question asked by the committee was, is there a comparison to other states? And yes, the employment positions that will be used for comparison include the federal government, other states, municipal government organizations, and the private sector employees to provide a wide range of comparison. And happy to take any questions.
Anybody have any questions on the salary study? Okay, we're looking forward to that to come forward as we deal with that. And I think there's some interest some consideration on the teacher salaries issues also. And it's all kind of blended together in attracting and retaining employees. So that's kind of in your bailiwick, but it'd be something I think would be helpful for the legislature to have also. Any other We have some remaining follow-up forthcoming. You want to comment on that, Ms. Sanders?
Yes. Chair Stedman, there are two items that we are working with the Department of Administration on. One was related to incentives offered to heavy equipment operators, especially at airports, gathering those letters of agreements. We'll have those for the committee. And then lastly, looking at recruitment efforts and gathering. There's been a lot of work in the area of recruitment and retention, and we haven't addressed each classification of employees the same way. And so evaluating how those have been, what steps have been taken across all JAB classes is a large undertaking. So we are gathering that information, and we'll have that for the committee.
Okay. Do you have any final questions for Sanders before she comes back before us with an amended budget in a few days? Okay, thank you. Next up, legislative finance. We'll have a brief at ease. On record. Okay, here we're going to go into legislative finance questions. Mr. Painter, if you can introduce yourself for the record and take us through a couple of these questions, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So there were four questions that I deferred to a future response. The first was from Senator Hoffman about how other large funds like the Permanent Fund handle inflation proofing. So Alaska's two-account system with the Permanent Fund principal and earnings reserve is relatively unusual for large funds of its type. If you have a retirement fund that many states do, you wouldn't have it separated. It's just one trust, or a sovereign country wouldn't necessarily, you know, Saudi Arabia can't keep itself from spending, so they'd have one account. The one fund we were able to find that had a really similar structure to ours was North Dakota's legacy fund that was established relatively recently. It has a constitutionally protected principal. The legislature of that state can spend only from the principal only with a two-thirds vote, and even then only 15% of the principal, and then it has the ability to spend the income. That fund does not have rules on inflation proofing. They've essentially decided what to do with the earnings each biennial budget cycle. So they don't have a rules-based framework for inflation proofing like we do. Actually, my predecessor, David Teal, traveled down to North Dakota to suggest that they adopt rules like Alaska's, and they did not do so. So they don't really have, as far as I can tell, they just budget biennium, and inflation proofing would be one of those items that they would choose to fund or not.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
What about other major university funds that have tens of millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars? Do you know of any of them, Harvard and all those Ivy League schools back east? Do they inflation-proof their funds?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, or Co-Chair Hoffman, most of them would have a single account, but a spending rule that accounts for inflation. So some of them use rules that use a blend of earnings and a percent of market value to try to ensure that inflation is accounted for in the draw. They wouldn't necessarily have two accounts like we do, but they would just account for that inflation as they set their draw percentage year to year.
Thank you.
Second question was from Senator Stedman about the historical comparison of production by oil field. This data actually just comes from the fall 2023 revenue sources book. we had presented a table that showed the change between the previous fall forecast to the new fall forecast. This shows the change in production from field to field. So I think a particular note was the production forecast showed a substantial reduction in Prudhoe Bay from forecast to forecast. If you look at it from year to year, the reduction is less. So there had been previously an expectation of more from Prudhoe Bay. Now it's an expectation of a bit less, but the year to year change is less than the forecast to forecast change. The next question was the total amount of the governor's FY24 vetoes. I think I guessed 200 million. The answer was 202.2 million. So I was close, but a little short. That was 145.4 million from the operating budget and 56.8 million from the capital budget, and that's UGF only. There may have been a couple of non-UGF vetoes as well that I didn't capture in that. Finally, Senator Merrick asked about how long it would take to retire the current school debt if the moratorium was extended indefinitely. Currently, there is debt out to FY40, although the amounts start to really drop off as it gets down to a single project after FY37. The districts or the municipalities do have the option to refinance that debt and extend payments, so it could keep extending if we get into a favorable interest rate environment again. Many districts did refinance when interest rates were favorable, and that often reduced payments and extended debt to a longer period. And finally, not on the list, but a question that was asked to OMB that I want to touch on briefly is the CBR balance. Last session, Legislative Finance had performed a calculation that said that if we had a balanced budget with the fall forecast, we would need $3.5 billion in the CBR to ensure that we had a 95% chance of being able to make it 2 years without emptying the fund. So essentially, we were applying methodology that's used by the state of Minnesota, that is one of the few states that has a kind of rules-based clear reserve target that's not just a percentage of their budget, but that's tied to volatility. And we calculated $3.5 billion at that time. And that was with a balanced budget. So note that if you don't have a balanced budget, the number would have to go up because part of what you'd have to account for would be the next year's deficit. So you'd say, well, we need to account for this year's billion-dollar deficit and then next year's billion-dollar deficit, or whatever the number might be, and then also account for volatility below that. So if we did it again this year, where we're facing an unbalanced budget but also a slightly lower oil price, we may get a different number. So the $3.5 billion is sort of it's a calculation based on another state's policy. We don't have a formal reserves target in the state, which is why it's debated so much. But we have not repeated that calculation yet this session.
Okay. Well, I think it seemed like a reasonable target. It's a little bit above what is expected to be in the CBR. So we can refine that as we move on to this budget cycle. And I hope the legislature comes out with a balanced budget this year. I think that comment of the reserve amount target hopefully will be reviewed in the other body, because I think it's an important subject. Clearly, zero doesn't work, and we can have a running discussion with the administration if it's $2.5 billion or $3.5 billion or some number, but it's we need to be within a reasonable range of passing the red face test. And I think your reference to 3.5 for us to strive for is a good recommendation. If we probably won't get there for a few years, the way it looks, but I think we need to have that target to try to reach versus the other direction. So appreciate that. We'll have you come back later when we get a better view of the budget, maybe in a month or so, depending on what's going on with the committee, to refresh that number.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions for him before he runs off? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Painter. We'll now have a brief at ease while we have Chairman Olson come forward. We're at ease.
Yeah, good morning. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. We have two bills on our agenda this morning. First bill is Senate Bill 141 by Senator Hoffman. The other bill is Senate Bill 24 by Senator Gray Jackson. The first bill, Senate Bill 141, the naming the Raymond and Esther Conquest Bridge by Senator Hoffman. This is the first hearing. Senator Hoffman, you ready to make some opening comments before you bring up your no comments? Okay. We'll have Sam Greeley come on up for the presentation this morning.
For the record, this is Sam Greeley, staff to Senator Hoffman. I want to start off and thank the committee for hearing Senate Bill 141. And with the permission of the chair, I can go into the sponsor statement.
Please do.
Okay. So on March 22nd, 2023, the Aleutnagik City Council and the Aleutnagik Tribal Council adopted a joint resolution 2302 requesting the legislature change the name of the Wood River Bridge to the Raymond and Esther Conquest Bridge. A little background on Raymond and Esther. Raymond was a heavy equipment operator for the DOT. He worked on the Lake Aleutnagik Road, which is better known as the gateway to the Woodtick-Chick Park. Raymond was a caretaker at the Nurka Lodge, which is on the second lake of the Woodtick-Chick Park. That's where he met his wife, Esther, and those two basically were inseparable. Raymond had a commercial fishing background. He had two boats, the Ricky T and the Gypsy. They would fish throughout the season. They would hunt for moose in the fall. Esther was known for her crafts. She was the BBNC 2007 Elder of the Year. And that's kind of their background. The reason why they're brought forward is before the bridge was there, Raymond and Esther, they would basically serve as emergency medical services for people to get to Dillingham for their hospital visits. And they transported hundreds of people and took care of folks when they had longer term health problems. And they just looked out for the community of Aleutnagik. And in 2005, when the bridge was constructed, Raymond was honored by being the first one to go over the bridge in his blue Chevy. So with that, I'm available for questions.
Is there any more history to the family? Are they from the area? Or
they are. Raymond, he's from Opka. It's a village that isn't, it's in the Bethel area. It's an abandoned village. And he had kind of a tough childhood. His parents passed away. He ended up in an orphanage in Holy Cross, and he ran away from that orphanage and eventually made it to Dillingham, where that's where he started as a young man. Esther, she grew up in Togiak, but she had health issues, and so she moved to Dillingham to be closer to healthcare. And she eventually had to go to the lower 48 to get treatment, but she made it back, and Aleutnagik was home for her. So,
any further questions by members of the committee for Mr. Greeley? If not, we have invited testimony. The first one is Jane Gottschalk, the vice mayor of Aleutnagik. Ms. Gottschalk, are you on, ma'am?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Go ahead and identify yourself for the record. Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, I'll go ahead and read my testimony. First of all, thank you so much for allowing me to testify for the name naming the bridge. Okay, hi. This is Jane Gottschalk, Vice Mayor of Aleutnagik, Alaska. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 141, naming Raymond and Esther Conquest Bridge. Esther Conquest was a lifelong resident of Aleutnagik and her husband Raymond Conquest moved to Alaknagik in the early 1960s and started his residency in Alaknagik. He was better known as Uncle Raymond in the community. Raymond and Esther were known for their generosity by many residents of Alaknagik because they provided transportation to many people in need, crossing the frozen lake with a snow machine in the winter months, and by boat during the summer and fall from North Shore to South Shore of Lake Alaknagik. Sometimes they would also row the boat when it started freezing and break ice to cross the lake from North Shore to South Shore at the point to get to the parking lot to access their vehicle on South Shore to drive the road to Billingham for medical appointments, catch a flight, or grocery shop. Raymond was also part of the road construction from Alaknagik to Billingham in the early 1950s. This road is better known as the Gateway to Woodtickchick State Park. Raymond held many jobs, and later on, him and Esther became Bristol Bay commercial fishermen. They also subsisted all their lives and taught their nieces and nephews how to subsist and trap. Esther was well known in Bristol Bay area for her fur sewing skills and received many ribbons for her work. Raymond served on many councils, including the Alaknagik Tribal Council, City of Alaknagik, and Alaknagik Natives Limited, and was the huge supporter of the bridge construction. Raymond commented once, "I am going to fight for the bridge until I die." In October of 2015 ribbon cutting bridge ceremony, Raymond was asked to be the first one to cross the newly constructed Wood River Bridge and in his old blue Chevy truck. Because of his continued fight for the bridge, a community of Alaknagik can cross the lake safely. And I would like to add that I know Alaknagik sleeps better now rather than worrying how we're going to cross from the lake from North Shore to South Shore for appointments. To honor Raymond and Esther Conquest and their services to the community, I support naming the bridge in Alaknagik to the Raymond and Esther Conquest Bridge. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the City of Alaknagik. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Vice Mayor Gottschalk. It's my understanding that a number of people had, before the bridge was constructed, a number of people had broken through the ice and maybe had some bad results of that. And so I'm sure it's a very necessary thing. We have any further questions from Vice Mayor Gottschalk by members of the committee?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have two people online. One is Catherine Keith, Deputy Commissioner of DOT, and Kurt Warren. If there's any questions for the about the DOT and its function down there. We're all open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that wants to go ahead and testify? I don't see anybody there. Is there anybody online that wants to testify? Okay, we'll go ahead and close public testimony then, since nobody's online. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside and take a brief at ease. Meeting back to order. Next, our next bill up is Senate Bill 24, Mental Health Education, by Senator L.B. Green Jackson. Please come on up with your aid and be ready to present it. This is the first hearing for this bill. Senator Green Jackson, go ahead and have your opening remarks, and then we'll turn it on over to your aide there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I really appreciate you hearing this bill. And although I'm a co-sponsor for this bill, I'm referring to it as this bill because it's not about me. It's about our kids who are in desperate need of resources to address the mental health crisis in our state. CSSB 24 amends the existing health education curriculum statute to include mental health in all K through 12 health classrooms to adequately educate students on vital information pertaining to mental health symptoms, resources, and treatment. The Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development and the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development will develop guidelines for instruction in mental health in consultation with numerous stakeholders. Such organizations include, but are not limited to, the National Council for Behavioral Health, Providence Health and Services Alaska, South Central Foundation, Anchorage Community Mental Health Services, Inc., North Star Behavioral Health System, and the National Alliance on Mental Health Illness in Alaska. The standards will be developed in consultation with counselors, educators, students, administrators, and other mental health organizations to form effective guidelines for school boards, teachers, and students. After standards have been developed, the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development, and D, will be responsible for implementation throughout the Alaska school system. As with existing health education curriculum, the DEED, the Department of Health, and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault will provide technical assistance to school districts in the development of personal safety curricula. An existing school health education specialist position will assist in coordinating the program statewide. CSSB 24 aims to decrease the stigma surrounding mental illnesses and increase students' knowledge of mental health, encouraging conversation around an understanding of the issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you'd like, my staff, Bessie Odom, can go over the sectional analysis.
First of all, let's ask if there are any questions by members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions by members of the committee of the bill sponsor? If nothing, Ms. Odom, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, committee members. For the record, Bessie Odom, staff to Senator Gray Jackson. The sectional analysis for CSSB 24 is as follows. Section 1, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska is amended by adding a new section to read legislative intent. The section specifies what entities will develop guidelines for instruction in mental health. Section 2 reads, the section amends AS 1403016A, which is the statute that relates to a parent's right to direct the education of their child, by adding a new subsection that would allow parents to be notified at least 2 weeks before any class or program regarding mental health is offered. Section 3 amends AS 1430360A, which addresses health education curriculum and physical activity guidelines by removing the word physical when referencing instruction for health education and adding mental health and physical health to the list of curriculum items each district includes in their health education programs. Section 4 amends AS 1430360B, which addresses health education curriculum and physical activity guidelines. This section clarifies that developmentally appropriate instruction for mental health be developed by the state board in consultation with Department of Health, Department of Family and Community Services, and other entities. This section also lists Department of Family and Community Services as one of the many entities that shall provide technical assistance to school districts in the development of personal safety curricula upon request. Section 5 reads, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska is amended by adding a new section to read report to the legislature. This section clarifies that a report must be given to the Senate Secretary and the Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives. This report must include a copy of developmentally appropriate instruction in mental health developed by the State Board of Education and Early Development and describe the process used to develop such guidelines. Section 6, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska is amended by adding a new section to read transition. Specifically, this section requires that the State Board of Education and Early Development shall develop the mental health guidelines within 2 years after the effective date of this act. Calling special attention to Section 7 of this sectional analysis, previously the effective date was listed as July 1st, 2023. Since this bill is being heard again this year, the effective date would presumably be July 1st, 2024 if this bill is enacted. Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee before Ms. Odom? Take a brief at ease. Senate Finance Committee, back to order. We have invited testimony. The first testifier is Ann Ringsted, who's the Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Alaska Incorporated. She's online. And Ms. Ringsted, would you please go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Ringsted, Executive Director for NAMI Alaska, the statewide organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thank you for your invitation to speak to the Senate Finance Committee about our support of SB 24 and mental health education. This bill has been a long time in the making, and we believe it contains the elements necessary to get it across the finish line at last. We want to thank Senator Gray Jackson and her staff for their tenacity in sponsoring this legislation over the years, and the Senate members who have co-sponsored this important piece of legislation. I will note here we've been collaborating with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Alaska chapter to advocate for this legislation over the past 3 years. Unfortunately, their representative came down with COVID today and is unable to testify. 1 in 6 youth in the United States ages 6 through 17 experiences a mental health disorder each year, and half of all mental health conditions begin by age 14. High school students with depression are more than 2 times more likely to drop out than their peers. It's estimated that over 8,000 Alaska students ages 12 through 17 have depression, and over 60% of them did not receive any care in the past year. Mental health challenges can interfere in a student's ability to learn, grow, and develop. Very often, it may be a teacher, counselor, or school staff that work with their students every day that recognize that a student is struggling, sometimes even before a parent is aware. Knowing how to talk about mental health with students is important. Coupled with the grim data point of Alaska being number 3 in the nation in suicides per capita, this is one proactive way to address this issue. Mental health should be on parity with physical health. You can't have one without the other. So what can we do to change the statistics? Schools should be encouraged to initiate and conduct programs in health education throughout K-12 to include mental and physical health in age-appropriate ways. What is really important is to open up the discussion about mental health so that students are not afraid to come forward if they are struggling. Strengthening the existing health curriculum guidelines in Alaska public schools in consultation with stakeholders will help to guide our youth throughout their formative years and beyond. Statewide mental health guidelines would be a great asset to the Alaska school districts. As a side note, NAMI Alaska already provides resources upon request to assist the schools in awareness of mental health issues for middle and high school students, as well as social and emotional supports for younger students. We're finding a real need for this dialogue as we move forward. We stand ready to assist the statewide effort to end the stigma of mental illness by participating in the two-year work group with the State Board of Education, state departments, and other organizations as outlined in the bill to create developmentally appropriate mental health guidelines for public schools to support our youth in their formative years. What we do now will make a difference in the long-term outcomes throughout life. We are all in this together. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of SB 24.
Mr. Ringstead, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Any questions of Mr. Ringstead by members of the committee? If not, thank you for coming out, and we have no further questions. Next up is Jen Griffiths, who is the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the Alaska Children's Trust. Ms. Griffin, are you on, ma'am?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Chair Olson and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Jen Griffiths. I'm Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for Alaska Children's Trust. Alaska Children's Trust is testifying today in support of Senate Bill 24. As the statewide lead organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect, we encourage policies that increase the health and well-being of Alaska's children and families. Senate Bill 24, which provides guidance to schools around mental health education, would support this goal by adding an option to include mental wellness curriculum as part of the health education for Alaska's youth. Alaska's adolescent suicide rate has long been among the highest in the country. In 2019, suicide was the leading cause of death for Alaskans aged 15 to 24, and 22% of high school students reported having planned a suicide attempt in the previous year. According to KidsCount data, in the last decade, the proportion of students feeling sad or hopeless has increased 52%. And from 2009 to 2019, the rise in suicidal ideation among Alaska teens has been alarming, with planning rates up 100% for male students and 80% for female students. The mental health pressures facing our youth today are numerous, from challenges navigating social media to the lasting impacts of the pandemic. Mental health and wellness are essential components of overall health. Just as we teach our youth how to maintain physical health and well-being, we should also be teaching them how to maintain mental health and well-being. Allowing local communities the choice and opportunity to offer more complete health curriculum would provide additional supports for parents, reduce stigma around mental health, and provide our children and youth knowledge and resources about mental wellness. Our youth are the next generation of parents. Policies that support their mental health and well-being will not only benefit this generation of Alaskans, but future generations as well. We encourage your support for Senate Bill 24.
Any questions by for Ms. Griffiths by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out this morning on this very important issue. I'd like to go ahead and go to public testimony. We have public testimony this morning on Senate Bill 24. Is there anybody in the room that wants to testify? I don't see anybody here. So we have one person online, Mr. Stephen Pierce. Mr. Pierce, are you on, sir?
Yes, I am.
Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. And I would note that we do have your letter here from the Citizen Commission on Human Rights, so we've got a perspective that you have. Go ahead with your, identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Stephen Pierce. I am the Director of Citizens Commission on Human Rights, and we deal with abuses in our psychiatric watchdog organization for the field of mental health. Now, this bill, we have several concerns, and we feel among them, we should just call to attention that, yes, we have had 5 decades of mental health treatment focusing on the issues that children are facing, and we have 6 million kids nationally on psychiatric drugs, and the statistics continue to go up and to rise. So we feel that there's been adequate experts who have pointed out these issues from articles in the New York Times, from the Alan Francis, who was the head of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for creation, and from Thomas Insull, who is the former head of the National Institute of Mental Health, all calling out, Insull is particularly noting this issue as the death rate, risk factors, suicide. Despite treatment, these have all been increasing over time. So doing more of the same does not appear to be the way to go for us. There's been a lot of calling out of issues critical of the way psychiatry is approaching labeling behavior as disease. And there is no clear differentiation between what adolescents are experiencing in the way of behavior and calling it a disease and justifying diagnosis, labels, and treatment. If anything is stigmatizing, it's calling a person who does not have anything objectively wrong with their brain, calling them mentally ill, giving them a label that then results in a treatment with a mind-altering drug. And that, I think, is part of it. And until that's recognized, I don't think that's going to resolve. There is a lot of material now from the United Nations, from the Mental Health, Human Rights, and Legislation and Guidance on creating a human rights-centered approach that validates the individual, yet it creates that dialogue. I mean, schools are a perfect place to identify and help children who have issues because they're outside the home and they're in a different environment. But that schools cannot be turned into a conduit or a pool for the mental health industry. So we feel it needs to be broader. So we provided some amendments that specifically address that. Where the focus of mental health education shall be on prevention and non-coercive forced concepts of mental health and adding in informed consent alternatives to the psychiatric labeling and drug delivery system for parents to consider. That's the First Amendment we propose, and a couple others there that help bring that about. So we want to call attention to those issues, and we urge a review of those materials and the whole issue of what has been being done. You know, should we just be doing more of that? And is that going to result in the same poor results that nobody's happy with? So that's how I would present this to you. There's much more that can be done. If the legislature would say, for example, to focus on non-drugging, non-coercive force solutions, and to broaden it up, there needs to be an alternative practitioner in mind. For example, you're never going to hear from a mental health advocate from the system about the 29 different causes of schizophrenia that are related to medical issues. So I think if you have people who are willing to explore actual causes of these emotional crises that people experience, that will open up the doors to resolutions and discussion and open debate about the issues. So we urge a broader view of how to treat mental health education in schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. Do you have any questions for Mr. Pierce, by members of the committee? If not, would either the bill sponsor or the staff would like to comment on some of his suggestions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Odom?
For the record, this is Bessie Odom, staff to Senator Gray Jackson. We feel that the concerns expressed by Mr. Pierce are best handled by those within the psychiatric field, if you will. This bill's intent is not to control the usage of psychiatric drugs. We're not interested in that particular topic when it comes to this bill, rather.
Okay, thank you very much for your comment. Is nobody else online? Nobody else is online, so we'll go ahead and close public testimony. We'll set this bill aside. And so this is the conclusion of our agenda for today. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. we'll be hearing from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. If there's no other business to come before the committee, we're adjourned at 10:12 a.m.